Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
It does look like late season heat will dominate much of the country, near to above normal temperatures virtually nationwide. The exception will be from the central Appalachians into the Northeast, a little bit on the cool side there.
Brad Rippey is a meteorologist with USDA looking at the extended forecast.
In terms of rainfall patterns from August 29th through September 4th, pretty much everything along and east of a line from the southern Rockies to the eastern Dakotas expected to be mostly drier than normal during this time. It's great for summer crop dry down, but not good for any immature summer crops, especially in drought affected areas. At the same time, we expect wetter than normal conditions in much of the west, extending from the Pacific coast all the way to the northern and central Rockies.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
I joined A&M about 5 years ago, or about 3.5 years ago, as his partner. So he and I are co-directors of the Ag and Food Policy Center.
Speaking earlier this year, Farm Bill expert and co-director of the Ag and Food Policy Center, or AFPC, at Texas A&M, Dr. Bart Fisher.
Prior to that, I spent 8.5 years in Washington, D.C. I was the chief economist of the House Ag Committee. First working for Chairman Lucas from Western Oklahoma on the 2014 Farm Bill, then staying on to work with Chairman Conaway on the 2018 Farm Bill. Worked on things like getting seed cotton added back to the Farm Bill back in 2018. And so after about 8.5 years, I got married and had 3 kids along the way, decided it was time to get them back to God's country. So we moved back to Texas. Prior to that, I had done my PhD at A&M.
When it comes to farm policy, it's more than just what's written on paper. It's how it's implemented on the farm.
I grew up in southwestern Oklahoma, pretty much straight east of here on a dry land cotton farm. We grow cotton, wheat, cattle as well. Still pretty involved. Dad says I'm not that involved, but I like to think I'm pretty engaged back home still. On the farm, try to stay pretty plugged in, but spend my days working at AFPC. I will say I teach about 186 undergraduate students on Tuesdays and Thursdays covering ag policy.
Now, 6 months ago was asked whether or not there could be an extension of the current farm bill.
What I've heard the chairman say is he has every intention of getting it done, and so I sort of stick with it there. You know, the point I've made is that if we're not going to get new money, though, you know, what's the point of doing it? And so, I mean, I think it's entirely feasible that it could get done this year. Do I think it's going to get done by September? Absolutely not. If y'all think back to the expiration of the 08 bill, do you remember hearing about the dairy cliff in the press? What ended up happening, I mean, the world doesn't fall apart on September 30th. Why? Mainly because we work in crop years on the farm policy side, right? You know, crop year being the heart of the year that you harvest. And so plant cotton in the spring, harvest in the fall, all the same. Wheat, you plant 1 year, harvest the next year. It's the year of harvest that's the crop year. And so September 30th can come and go because the farm bill's already authorized PLC for that crop year. And so what ends up happening, though, you get to the end of the year, you start to get to January 1, policies like dairy that could trigger every single, you know, well, we start to think about wheat, you know, the marketing loan coming up in May or June. Dairy could trigger every single, you know, could trigger every single day. And so that's why you heard about the dairy cliff on January 1. So typically they can push it all the way to January without the world falling apart. And I mean, I was hand-wringing and worried about, you know, permanent law kicking in, because we also had folks saying, well, if permanent law kicks in and we eliminate it, how many hundreds of billions can we get credit for saving by eliminating permanent law? So like squirrely stuff happens, but I think through the end of the year, you got no problems. And then one last point, I'll quit belaboring it. Think of when we actually got to the point of signing the 14 Farm Bill. It wasn't signed until President Obama signed it in early February. I think it passed the House late January 29th of 14. There was no extension. We had extended the farm bill for a year. We made it all the way to February without the world falling apart. So I think there's quite a bit of runway. Will I be surprised to see it slip into next year? Not at all. It all comes back to that 4-vote margin. Where do they find the 218 in the House? Like everything is around finding 218 votes and navigating that 4-vote margin.
An area of optimism is Republican leadership on other committees.
In terms of lineup at the top, I don't know that you could pick a better crew out of the 435 members that are up there. You've got four really good leaders sitting at the top of those committees. Now, how does it interact with that reality of a 4-vote margin? We're about to find out.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
There's some things we can do both short-term and long-term to try to add value to a set of calves that we're going to be selling at some point this fall.
Dr. Mark Johnson is Oklahoma State University beef breeding specialist.
So, in no particular order, if I were buying a set of wean calves, what would have value to me? Well, first thing is probably just uniformity, and uniformity and volume is what increases the value of a set of wean calves. What do we mean by uniformity? If we could sell steers or heifers, if we knew that those heifers were open, if we knew that they were all the same color, looked like they're out of the same sire group and the same set of cows, all those are basic fundamentals of uniformity that create value in the marketplace. But uniformity in age and uniformity in the weight of those calves also plays a role. Typically, calves that have less than 100 pounds of variation, no more than 60 to 90 days age variation in them, are going to create uniformity. Now, we may ponder whether we pool calves with a neighbor to create some of these larger lots of cattle. As we discussed last week, anytime we could put together a uniform semi-load lot, somewhere around 50,000 pounds of calves to sell, it's going to aid in economizing the cost of transportation wherever those calves are going to next. So uniformity has value. Management. Now, what do we mean by management? Basically, if we have backgrounded calves, if we've got two rounds of vaccinations in them at the point that they're weaned, even if we just wean those calves for 45 days and have got those vaccinations in them, whoever's going to own those calves next is going to want health, a good immune system, and know that there's going to be less treatment necessary in that set of calves when they get ready to turn them out on wheat pasture or whatever they plan to do with them. Those are things we can add from a management standpoint, as well as just making sure if we've got some horns on calves, that we dehorn them. The standard in industry is we sell cattle, they're going to be dehorned, those bull calves are going to be turned into steer calves, they're all going to be castrated and healed. Additional things we may do to even go a click beyond that is, are those calves bunk broke? Do they know to come to feed whenever it's presented to them? That's another thing that if I were buying wean calves, there's benefit to that. What kind of information can we provide on a set of calves about their genetic potential? This revisits a topic from last week. Do we know the historical post-weaning growth performance, cost to gains, carcass quality, carcass cutability, carcass weights on what those calves are when they actually finish out? If we can provide some history and some past data on a set of calves, it obviously gives those calves additional marketing leverage to whoever's going to own them next. And so just a number of things to think through. If we're willing to provide some of that information or willing to manage for some of that information, the opportunity provided in Oklahoma Quality Beef Network sales and the website showing on screen is where you can go to get more information on an OQBN sale, where we know that backgrounded vaccinated calves are actually, as well documented, are going to sell at a premium. So there's some marketing outlets there, but in the end, bottom line, we can either sell our calves and be a price taker, or we can provide some additional management, maybe some information about genetics and uniformity in that calf crop to market them at an additional profit point beyond that commodity price.
This is Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The president and the administration, my boss, have been clear that we need reform in the WTO to meet the work demands of workers and businesses today.
Greg Dowd served as the chief ag negotiator for the U.S. Trade Representative's office during the Trump administration.
We have been very proactive on that front, whether it gets discussed in the media very much or not. And our big thing that we're talking about in agricultural and issues in the WTO is transparency. Members must be transparent and abide by their obligations in terms of notifying trade-related measures, notifying their agricultural domestic supports, ensuring that those countries that do not need special and differential treatment don't get it. And, you know, we have a huge number of countries right now in the world that do get that. So our goal here in the WTO is to reset these negotiations, The world has changed since we started this Doha round discussion now almost 20 years ago. A lot has changed, and we are making that point repeatedly in these international settings. This issue of transparency isn't just a buzzword that we're using. We did something in my first trip to Geneva a year ago that was unprecedented, never been done before in agriculture. I had an opportunity to slide across the table to my counterpart in India, what we call a counter notification in the WTO. And that's a really interesting thing where we don't file a WTO case, but in this case of India, we looked and saw what India sent to the WTO in terms of what its subsidies were. And our colleagues at the Foreign Ag Service, at USDA, folks at USTR, the lawyers, we spent a bunch of time looking at India's own websites, studying their subsidies. And what that piece of paper said that we slid across the table was, you know, this is what you said your subsidies were. When we looked at your own websites, which they took down after we had this conversation, and that says that in rice, you're actually subsidizing to a point that is 8 times what you say you are, and in wheat, about 6 or 7 times what you say you are. What's up with that? And of course, you know, blew up and had all these conversations. Well, this has been interesting, and laying this groundwork on this. So now we've got rice, wheat, cotton, 5 different kinds of pulses. Canada's helped us with this. Now Australia is involved in this. And in fact, now Australia in particular, they've got a little counter notification going on sugar programs. And in fact, on July 22nd of this year, Australia, Brazil, and Guatemala initiated a WTO case, a dispute settlement procedure against India on its sugar programs. So that's a way to show a little leadership in the world, isn't it? We didn't hit them hard. We just said, you know, interesting that you're subsidizing rice at 8 times what you say you are, and the fact that you're the world's biggest rice exporter. And so this is the kind of point that we've got to help other countries in the world and help everybody here understand that these are tough conversations that we have to have.
Bottom line, it comes to self-declarations.
We're just beginning to raise that issue of self-declaration here again. It's been an issue that we've known about for a long time. You know, we have the G20, arguably the world's 20 largest economies. Would it surprise you to know that half of the G20 says that it's a developing country in the WTO? Singapore, Abu Dhabi, South Korea, China. So obviously, you know, we need some things to change here.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Particularly following COVID, where you saw the huge spread between farm gate prices and retail prices, there was a lot of angst around the country, particularly about fed cattle pricing.
Dr. Bart Fisher, co-director of the Ag and Food Policy Center, AFPC, at Texas A&M.
You know, who was really making money during that time frame? And so there's a lot of interest on Capitol Hill, particularly in regulating fed cattle pricing, imposing mandatory minimums on the volume of cattle that would have to be negotiated instead of formula price or traded on a grid. And so there was a lot of attention there. And for a while, a lot of folks thought that that might spill over into the farm bill. With where we are now, you know, amazing what can happen in a few months with where cattle prices are. We just sold a bunch of wean calves coming off the little bitty tiny bit of wheat pasture we had sent to Oklahoma City earlier this week. You know, with prices where they are now, this debate has softened to some degree. It's not that it didn't that it went away, and some of you may still have very strong opinions about it. I just don't anticipate that it's going to spill over into the farm bill.
But what can happen with just a few words in a farm bill?
Back in 2018, you know, we really spent 2.5 years. Conaway came in as chairman in 2015. We really spent about 2.5 years trying to figure out what the heck to do on cotton, right? The 14 farm bill, the Cotton Council had proposed stacks as an alternative. We know what happened. China stockpiles 60+ million bales of cotton. Price goes through the floor, right? We have to have an alternative. We spent about 2.5 years trying various approaches to get it done, and ultimately the one we landed on was to add seed cotton back to the farm bill. If you want to talk about how and why and all that, I'm happy to go through that in Q&A. But we talk about that a lot. But that same bill, it was a budget bill, the Bipartisan Budget Act of 2018. It passed in February of 2018. It included hurricane relief, but part of that was the original authorization for the WIP program. We're now in 6 years of ad hoc assistance, and it all started there. It's also where seed cotton came about. Why am I bringing it up here? Because one single line in that bill, which never really gets any attention, has to do with risk management for livestock. Historically, USDA could not spend, and this is by statute, USDA could not spend more than $20 million a year indemnifying livestock policies. It was just written, you know, hard-coded right into the U.S. code that they could not spend more than that. In that bill, again, Chairman Conway was the one leading the charge at the time. Seed cotton was the big focus. It caught all the attention. There was a line in the bill that struck that provision, that limitation. Okay, I won't do to y'all what I do to the 186 students who sit in front of me for a class, but this is the one audience participation because I'm curious. 2018, RMA insured about $500 million in liability on livestock. What do you think it hit last year with that provision struck? $500 million in 18. What is it now? Any takers? $2 billion up front. Any others? Any other bids? I got $2 billion up front. $21 billion, a 40-fold increase. So the notion of, well, there's no, I get nothing out of that farm, but I get nothing out of D.C. if I'm a livestock producer. If you're not getting anything, it's because you're not looking close enough. And I don't mean any offense. I mean it more as encouragement. If you're not engaged on this subject, on this topic, and it applies to you, I'd highly encourage you to look because there's a lot of stuff coming down the pike. Not the least of which is a new policy being developed right down in Lubbock for weaned calves. They're just like you have RP on your cotton or your corn or your sorghum or wheat or whatever, there's going to be a new RP policy on weaned calves coming. And so liability and insurance in 5 years has increased by 40-fold, 4,000-plus percent over the last 5 years alone. And it all goes back from one line in that one bill back in 2018. And so just to make y'all aware of that.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
I hope to bridge the gap between farmers and their supply chain partners downstream and upstream of the farm gate as well.
John Duff is with Cerro Ag.
There is so much interest, as we've talked about over and over, in sustainability these days. And that's great. That's really good. I think that gives a lot of opportunity for agriculture. But it also is it can be a little threatening in that there's a lot of people from outside of agriculture that are getting really involved in agriculture and not just kind of from a high level, but they're getting down into the weeds too and talking about farm practices and how that ultimately impacts the end good for the consumer. And when you have that, folks outside of agriculture getting deep in the weeds of agriculture, there can be some risk in that. And so standing in that gap and being the bridge between the farmer and the folks that are getting interested in what the farmer does, is really my mission, vision, objective, goal. And I get up every day, trying to figure out how, I make life better for whether it's sorghum farmer or other farmers, in that space, where they're talking to their consumer.
What's something exciting in the sorghum industry?
Of course, National Sorghum Producers was awarded a $65 million Climate Smart grant through USDA's Climate Smart Partnerships program. I'm super excited about that. It's going to be incredible. It's moving pretty slowly, as federal grants do. But we hope to be out in 2023 and for sure by 2024 paying farmers to adopt climate smart practices and then collecting data along the way and then compensating them for that at the end of the year. We're really excited about that. Working on the next piece of that though and looking towards water and especially and also nitrogen use efficiency and things of that nature. You're exactly right. I think that we're doing those things for a couple of reasons. One of them, of course, is ag productivity. If you're being climate smart, that means you're being more productive and you're being more efficient. You're doing more with less anyway. So there's that, that benefits actually the farm's bottom line. But there's also the consumer that wants that, the consumer that's asking us to be climate smart, the consumer that's asking for those climate smart practices because they're increasingly concerned about their environmental footprint that traces back to the farms that are producing the foods that they're consuming. And so, again, bridging that gap, that's why I started Cerro, is to bridge that gap between the farmer employing climate smart practices, maybe under the National Sorghum Producers Climate Smart Grant, and then ultimately that consumer that's buying a sorghum flour that he or she wants to know was produced in a sustainable manner.
He also says while it's important to receive, it's also important to give back.
The South Crest Christian School, based here in Lubbock, has started an ag program. They're one of the first in the state of Texas FFA programs and vocational ag programs at a private school, and they're certainly the first one in this area. And I've helped with, you know, curriculum development and some fundraising things. And, that's an incredible way to give back. And it's been really good because, for example, that's, you know, helped me think about strategy in a completely different way and in ways that I'll be able to come back and employ, in the sorghum industry, a lot and in really important ways. And certainly, you know, the faith-based aspect and the other areas that I'm able to give back are great as well, and ultimately are going to help me work to benefit sorghum producers in the future. But that's a pretty cool opportunity, and we'll be working on a number of other ones along those same lines over the next few years.
This is Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The concerns that we are raising with China are concerns that have been shared by countries around the world for many, many years.
Comments from former chief ag negotiator with the U.S. Trade Representative's office, Greg Dowd, 4 years ago.
And I can say an important element of our negotiations has been to resolve a large number of unwarranted and long-standing trade barriers on U.S. agricultural exports. Let me give you, again, in talking in broad numbers, this context. I've talked about U.S. exports of $145 billion. China last year imported from the world $124 billion in agricultural products alone. Think about that. So our total exports are $145. China's total imports of ag are $124. And I've made the point to my counterpart when we started these discussions. I said, here's the gist of it. In a good year, China, you, Vice Minister, you import $20 billion of your $124 from us. But given the capacity of U.S. agriculture to export, 20 out of 124 just isn't going to cut it. And what do I mean by that? Let me help you understand the context of this. Yes, we sold China about $13 billion of that in just soybeans alone. But other than soybeans and maybe cotton, there really isn't another agricultural commodity where we don't have conflict in our trading relationship with China. And let me walk you down through this. China last year bought $5 billion in beef. You know how much of that we did? Maybe $70 million. Because of, we're talking about mad cow disease from 15 years ago. One of the few countries in the world, maybe now almost the only country in the world, we haven't resolved this. We are frustrated with them in the relationship over pork and a thing called ractopamine. We haven't sold them a pound of poultry since high-path avian influenza here in 2015. We used to sell them over $1 billion in distiller's grains. They knocked us out. The anti-dumping duty. We'd love to sell them some ethanol. We're tinkering around the edges. We had two of the biggest WTO cases in history that earlier this year that we have won that have restricted what we can do on corn, what we can do on rice, what we can do. We'd never have been able to sell them rice here until they bought 40 tons here the other day after all these years of working on this. So let's go down through this. $1 billion in beef, we think we can do. Pork should be over $1 billion. Poultry should be over $1 billion. Distillers is well over $1 billion. Ethanol, corn, wheat, cotton. My favorite is pet food. We think that market's a $500 million market for pet food, and we can't even get our little toe in there. So as you go down through looking at these agricultural commodities and the potential that we have with China, this is the context of the conversation that we have had. The document we have negotiated with China is thick. Ladies and gentlemen, we have argued almost over every sentence. We have spent hours and hours and hours talking about this. We've made a lot of progress with them. We haven't resolved everything yet, but we've made a lot of progress. And the point I'm making here is that the unwarranted barriers are long, and what we're asking for is significant structural change in our trading relationship to eliminate these barriers. One of the remarkable issues that we talk about all the time is biotechnology. China is the only country in the world that in order to approve a biotech trait, you have to send them the seeds. Really?
At the end of the two-year agreement, China only purchased 58% of what they said they would. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
What began last spring as efforts to resolve the issue?
We are urging Mexico to address our concerns with agricultural biotechnology. We recently requested technical consultations with Mexico under the USMCA, and we will continue to consider all options available under that agreement to fix this problem.
Has led our nation and U.S. Trade Representative Catherine Tai to recently seek resolution under a U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement dispute settlement panel. That after both technical and dispute settlement consultations between our country and Mexico came to an impasse. The dispute stems from Mexico imposing measures last February designed to ban biotech corn in products such as tortillas and dough. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack, via press release, said the U.S. call for the dispute settlement panel is part of the USMCA process to assure fair, open, science and rules-based trade among member nations. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.